Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Internet spam is nothing new, but in the last few months, the scourge of email inboxes around the world has exploded again. Call me, hey Johnny, love pills, big bucks, the subject lines are like bad haiku. But the story behind a new breed of super spam, spam 2.0, is like a high-tech crime thriller. Russian gangsters, African scams, renegade Romanian geeks, and a huge price tag for the world, 9 out of 10 emails are now said to be spam. Some harmless, except for the time they gobble up. Some will pick your pocket. Some can take over your computer and make it a zombie foot soldier in the global spam wars. At risk, money, privacy, and the very utility of the Internet. We will speak in this hour with experts on the front line of the escalating spam war. But first, we turn to Brad Stone in New York. He's technology correspondent for the New York Times. He's been tracking the new onslaught and new breed of spam. Brad Stone, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what is this super spam, spam 2.0, that's got 9 out of 10 email messages now spam? What are the new tricks of the trade, Brad?
That's right. Well, it does look a little bit different than the email messages we were receiving in our inboxes unsolicited just a few years ago, which, you know, tended to be mostly text, mostly offering, you know, certain pharmaceuticals or links to pornographic websites. Well, the spammers have a few tricks of the trade that are new these days. A lot of the messages we see are image spam, so they're basically just graphics or illustrations, and the entire message is basically presented graphically, and what that does is basically elude traditional anti-spam filters that look for text.
So when the spam isn't showing up in my junk file, but it's right there in my main email category, it's because sometimes what? They're essentially delivering an image of text rather than text itself.
Exactly. I mean, one major strategy that all of our anti-spam filters use is to look for keywords, you know, triggers. Another strategy that most anti-spam filters employ is looking for links. So, you know, outbound links or just web addresses to suspicious websites.
Where's it coming from? What's it associated with? Right.
Well, okay, so that's one, right? Who's the source of the email? And then the other is, does the spam message link to a suspect website? Well,
okay.
Spammers have ways of avoiding both of those. Number one, the spammers are increasingly using what we call botnets, which are vast networks of, you know, computers owned by innocent people who have downloaded in the past some spyware, and their computers have basically been turned into spam zombies. And that's really underlying the huge explosion in the amount of spam, which is that spammers have access to this just tremendous network of other people's computers.
And this is ordinary people, ordinary personal computers. I'm reading here in the Times of London, they tracked 150,000 Britons who had had their computers hijacked. They were sending out billions of emails every day for porn and drugs and shares of stock. Most of these people won't have any idea that their computer is part of a spam ring.
I think that's exactly true. I mean, I think there are some signs if your computer is, you know, performing poorly, is slow, cumbersome, you might want to run some anti-spyware software. But let's address the second point, which is, you know, why so much of this new, you know, breed of spam, you know, doesn't contain outbound links to websites. It's because most of the spam we're seeing, and people will be familiar with this, are touting stocks these days. You know, they're saying, buy this hot new company. So what that does is there's no link to any pornographic or pharmaceutical website. It's saying, buy this stock. And what the spammers are doing is called the pump and dump scheme. They're buying shares in these very small, obscure companies, and then when the gullible masses out there buy the stock, they can sell and make a little profit.
Now, from the spammer's point of view, part of what's ingenious or fiendishly ingenious about that is that there's no direct link. It all happens up in a stock market. They don't have to get you to come to them. You just buy, but do people actually buy stocks based on spam stock tips?
It seems absolutely ridiculous, but two universities, Purdue and a researcher at Oxford, conducted a study last summer where they just looked at the stock prices of the companies that were being touted in spam emails, and they found, indeed, the stock prices did rise. I mean, the fact is that a lot of these stocks that are touted in spam trade on these very small exchanges, these over-the-counter computerized exchanges, and it doesn't take much to drive the price up. So if you find a few gullible or maybe greedy people that are looking to ride the wave, you know, it pays off for the spammer.
And there's a structural reason for it, as you described, that then they can make money without being directly tied to any place on the web where that which would provide an address where they can be found or tracked down. Who's doing most of this, Brad?
Well, exactly. I mean, that leads us to the next point, which is who are the spammers? I mean, a couple years ago when we covered this trend, it was, you know, folks in America with maybe a sort of, you know, unrigorous ethical sense that thought, hey, we're capitalists, we're making money, you know, it's just marketing. Well, anyways, the Canned Spam Act was passed in 2003, and, you know, which among other things made, you know, spammers allow recipients to opt out of the email and impose some penalties for violating the law. And what it did is it pushed the spammers underground and
offshore very often,
right?
Yeah.
So now we see Russian spammers, Eastern European and Asian spammers. They're sort of operating outside the arm of American law enforcement.
What about the counter efforts here? I know there's a lot of money that's going into it, but you remind us, it was just a couple, 3 years ago, Bill Gates was saying that junk email spam would be solved by this year. Now you're quoting industry people saying, I think we're losing. The bad guys are simply outrunning most of the technology out there. How can that be?
I mean, I'm sure Bill Gates would love to take those comments back, and I think he also imagined a sort of more rigorous system, you know, than we have in place now. But, we do have to realize that the anti-spam vendors are probably quietly smiling right now, the spam software companies,
sure,
because, you know, this is great for them. They're going to sell more software. But, you know, the fact is that most of them have always, you know, filtered 90 to 95% of spam, and you know, the trick is not bringing legitimate emails into the spam quarantine filter. You know, but the fact is spam's so far up now that the 3 to 5% that does get through, it starts to be a real problem.
Well, spam can sound like a trivial issue, Brad. You suggest that it's not. What's the impact?
Well, I think it varies. I mean, I remember there were studies back in, you know, 2003 in the first wave of spam that said that, you know, the average user spends a couple seconds deleting every message. And maybe that's exaggerated, but it does build up. There is a productivity issue. Small companies in particular that can't afford the big anti-spam solutions, you know, are overwhelmed right now. You know, it's something that's hard to measure, but overall, you know, it just dilutes the impact of email as this great productivity tool that we've all sort of become, you know, come to rely on these past few years.
And pretty soon we're all dealing with the sort of criminal and fluff stuff at the edges, and the core function gets impinged on in some way. Brad Stone, appreciate your opening the curtains on this for us today. Thanks for your reporting, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Brad Stone, technology correspondent for the New York Times, joined us from New York. I'm joined now in our studio by Jeff Schiller, Internet Network Manager at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Security Architect with MIT's Information Technology Architecture Group. He's on the front line in these global spam wars. Jeff, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
So zombie networks pumping this out, how big a factor is that, this taking over of PCs around the country, around the world, to become the engine of spam production?
Well, I'll tell you, when Brad said that there was 100-some-odd thousand machines taken over in Britain, the thought that went through my head was, that's a low number. Typical zombie networks can be five times that.
And this is mostly, I guess by definition, has to be just ordinary people. How does one's computer get taken over by spam and turned into a spam generator?
Well, there's several ways it can happen. Ironically, the first way it can happen is you just receive a piece of spam that has some program in it that when you open the program, it takes over your computer. You can be directed to a website, or you go to a website that can then download software onto your computer that takes it over. There's any number of ways that it can happen.
Do I have to actively engage with the spammer in order for my computer to be taken over? If I just open and read the mail, is that enough to get in trouble, or am I safe?
Well, that depends. If your computer's completely up to date, you should be reasonably safe. But I have to put a caveat there. That's not 100%. But in general, yes, all it takes is opening the message.
But I've also heard that now with Outlook, if that's what you're reading your email on, just previewing it, just having the preview window open is enough to get in trouble. How does that happen?
Well, it turns out that when Outlook looks at a message even in preview mode, it looks to see if there's any executable content in it, namely a program, and if it finds one, it'll still run it.
So I, without even fully opening the spam email message, my computer could be locked in a dance with the spammer.
Yes. Now, I have to clarify that a little bit. If you're completely up to date on your patches, you're probably okay.
When you say patches, these are the security software patches, upgrades that come down the line.
Security updates that come from Microsoft, as well as any updates that come from your antivirus vendor. And, of course, you have antivirus software on your computer.
Yeah, of course. Do you have a mental image of where all this is being generated? I mean, the Times of London says, you know, we've got like just a couple of hundred people, maybe even 10, who dominate this now out of Eastern Europe. Does that jive with your understanding of what's going on?
I'm not sure it's as few as 10. It's probably somewhere between 10 and 1,000, but it's not millions of people. I think most of this is being caused probably by less than 1,000 individuals, but it's really hard to tell.
And after the sort of lull in spam we had a few years ago, now it's come back big time. Lots of people have noticed it in the last 3, 4, 5, 6 months. Does that mean that we can't count on a long-term victory of the forces of the anti-spam? I mean, might the spammers have a more advantageous position long-term?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, if those of us who remember Mad Magazine, there was this allusion to spy versus spy, this continual escalation that goes on. And I think we're in that type of loop. We get better at filtering it. They get better at breaking through the filters. It's not clear there'll ever be a victory or defeat. I think it's just going to go on like this.
So a new feature of a new internet, globalized, wired up world.
Yeah, it's sort of the internet meets the real world.
Yeah. We're going to get right out on the front lines of spam, the spam wars in this hour, and they really are something to witness at this point. But I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Sam's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm running a small business with maybe 6 to 7 computers.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the computers we're using for our emails and, you know, browsing, but this computer, I bet it's been taking over by this spam and spyware, and it's just now we've got this thing that they make pops at a sound as well, every like maybe 30 seconds. That is really annoying. And you know, if you want to take these to the shop, they charge us about $175 a piece to clean them. And you know, the minute it comes back, the same thing happens in a week or so. We're kind of stuck in here, and you know, we put McAfee and you know, adware, but not doing anything.
And Sam, does it hit your productivity? Can you feel it as a burden on your business?
Absolutely. Every 30 seconds, you got these things popping up, and now they make sounds, and they give you warning that your computer is about to, you know, explode or whatever, and where all information is being taken away, and you got to buy this, you got
to
buy that.
Right. No way to run a business or try to. Thanks for that. Let's see what advice we can get from Jeff Schiller. Sam's got his business computer, you know, snap, crackle, popping right there, and it feels like it's absolutely flooded with this stuff. What's the best thing? What can he do?
Well, if the computer's been completely taken over, the best thing to do at this point is to take any files on it that you actually care about and take them off the computer and to just reinstall the computer from scratch.
And with that, you'll be clean of whatever's been installed there. And then is there some effective way to keep any of this junk from coming in again?
Well, the only thing that we know for sure to do that is to make sure that you're absolutely up to date. You know, obviously, if you're running Windows, make sure you have auto update turned on. Have a good antivirus product and make sure that gets updated on a daily basis, what they call the DAT file updates, and then you hope for the best.
And wipe it clean and start again. That is a major hassle. You can just imagine what it's like to run a business with that. I want to turn now to San Carlos, California, and Dan Drucker. He's vice president of marketing at Postini, one of the leading email management companies around with more than 35,000 business customers. They watch a lot of email travel and a lot of spam as well. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So do these numbers sound right to you? 9 out of 10 emails sent globally now spam? Does that sound legitimate?
It's even a little bit higher than that. We blocked more than 22 billion of these last month. which is an all-time record. And because we track this across 11 million people around the world, we can give you a pretty good idea of exactly what's going on. So it's an all-time high. As of a few weeks ago, 93% of all messages on the internet are spam globally.
Who do you picture out there on the other side of this spam war? I'm looking here at a recent news story, Interpol, asking for more tools to go after organized crime. The London Times talking here about, individual kind of spam, arch-villains here. Amichai Inbar, a Russian in Tel Aviv with his network through Eastern Europe and into the United States. Do you have individuals or individual networks or organized crime gangs in mind on the other side of this table from you?
It's yes to all of these things. It's a few years ago, this was a way for annoying hackers to show off. Then it evolved to, in the arms race that you talked about in the last segment, to annoying marketers trying to sell us all Viagra. Today, clearly a large chunk of this is coming from criminals, convicted felons that are trying to steal your money, steal your identity, commit credit card theft, tremendous increase in stock manipulation schemes. So it's the bad guys are much scarier than they used to be.
And we got the stock piece of it, and Lord knows inboxes are full of these stock tips now and come-ons, and when people participate, drives the stock up a little bit. Presumably the spammers flip their stock, make a little money, and off they go. What else? How else do people make money off of spam?
So there are really two ways. One is they make money through the fraud they're trying to commit. So it's they make money doing identity theft, stealing your credit card, the kind of classic criminal behavior. They are absolutely making money, and you can see it when you track what these stock pumping up schemes do. And then the third thing that's happened that's more recent is you talked about the botnets. These guys are now renting out their botnets to other people. There's actually an underground economy where they'll sell these to each other so they can all send more of these attacks against you.
No, the botnets, again, the sort of zombified computers that are drafted into this army of PCs sending out spam. So there's an underground business in renting out, could be my computer or yours at home, Dan, to go to work for
right.
the spammers.
We track more than 1 million of these attacking on every 24 hours. And these are typically home computers, just like you got from the last caller, that are attached via high-speed networks to the Internet, via cable modem or DSL. And there are millions of them that have been taken over.
Now, on the credit card fraud side, do I have to actively type in my credit card number for them to grab it and begin to use it, or are there other techniques?
That's the most common technique. So every year, people ask, why is this so big now? Every year in the holiday season, we see a big spike in the amount of spam. It's just bigger than it's ever been before right now. And the reason it's in the holidays is because more consumers are online shopping for holiday presents and gifts. They've got their credit cards out. They're more vulnerable. So the thing you definitely don't want to do is respond to an email from your bank or your credit card company that says, we've lost your information. We need you to verify it. That's called phishing, and they're absolutely trying to steal your personal information.
Jeff Schiller, do you feel this same shift from the kind of, there was a time when it was sort of geek bravado to go out and mess with the system. Has that receded now to be supplanted by crime, organized crime? Is that your view as well?
Well, I think it's the organized crime has added to it. I don't think the kids, lids, and space cadets, as we used to call them, have gone away. But indeed, the real threat is from the real criminalized behavior.
Let me go to Cedar Falls, Iowa, and Wade. Hi, Wade. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My question was having to do with filtering these spam emails, why we can't, instead of trying to filter the content of the email itself, why we can't filter it based on the origin. So if it's not a recognized person or origin that you've determined that's acceptable, then it would just be kicked out.
So you'd have a sort of an approved list of people who could email you, and otherwise, no matter where it came from, you wouldn't accept it, Wade?
Yes, something like that.
Jeff, what do you think of it?
Well, I mean, if you control your own mail system, you can do things like that. You can say, I'll only accept connections from places I know are people I want to talk to. But when you run an institution like MIT, we have to take mail from all over the place. If we tried to build a list of acceptable places, it would be too long and too hard to maintain.
So it's just too much to stay on top of. Dan Drucker, what about going out to the point of origin? Is that practical for individuals, for companies?
It actually doesn't work. Because the way email works today is that the bad guys can fake who they are. So one of the most common mistakes we people make is that they'll say, I want to accept all emails from eBay because I know that's a recognized company to do business with.
Yeah.
So now the bad guys just fake that they're eBay. So what we do is actually we look at the behavior of the senders, and we will block about 60% of those 22 billion messages by looking at is a particular sender behaving like a bad guy.
So this could be the bad guy's own computer or a zombie botnet computer that's an unwitting accomplice. Either way, it just depends on what they do is what you're looking at.
That's correct.
All right, so maybe that's one way, and still it comes. Let me go to Pepperell, Massachusetts, and Robert. Hi, Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're all right.
My question is, there's a lot of talk about productivity loss and, identity theft and all that.
Mm-hmm.
What about the backbone of, American networks? Is spam something that, takes up a lot of bandwidth and prevents, normal people from being able to enjoy the bandwidth they have, or is it something, that's a much smaller problem?
Right. Is it marginal or is it gumming up the works? Jeff Schiller, if 90% of email is spam, is that a burden on the Internet backbone itself, the web?
At this point, actually, it's not. It's much more of an annoyance to us humans than it is to the various computers. Our network, for example, hardly notices it.
Because compared to everything that flows over the web, this is relatively minor?
Yeah, I mean, one person looking at a webcast of high-speed or high-quality video is going to be a lot more than any large number of email messages.
Dan, what about the overall impact on the kind of internet world of this scale of spam traffic?
That's right. So it's absolutely correct. This is not a threat to the capacity of the internet. Where it comes in is it's a threat to the viability of email and to the capacity of email systems. So what actually is happening with the new attacks is that the email portion of typically a business is getting overwhelmed by the increase in attacks. The caller is on a great point. In the last year alone, the size of spam is up by 4.5 times. And many companies that block this stuff haven't budgeted, for 4.5 times more capacity in their email systems. It's clearly not a threat to the internet as a whole.
Though I have to say, my own use of the internet has been kind of changed by this. I mean, you start to get suspicious about PayPal. I find myself writing checks and putting them in snail mail in the U.S. postal system rather than fooling around with the online world. Just because, who knows, Jeff? Am I getting too spooked there? Am I superstitious?
Well, I think, because of the Fisher attacks and what have you, you do have to be careful about how you enter your credit card online and are you really entering it into some place valid. One thing I actually recommend people do is that if you're going to buy things online, always use the same credit card and have or at least maintain one credit card that you never use online so that if you do get into a situation where you have to start canceling your credit cards, you still have one that is safe to use.
So keep a clean one. One may be exposed to Lord knows what. Rod's calling from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Rod. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm curious, I bought a brand new PC because I think my old one was corrupted by spam. So now I just don't open the spam mail. But sometimes I'll let go 2 or 3 days before I'll open it, and I have hundreds and hundreds of it. Then I'll delete them.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if me storing them for that period of time, can that affect my computer? And a lot of times I just look at the spam because once in a while I get something that, for some odd reason, I get it all the time, but it ends up spam and I need to read it.
Right.
But I was wondering, all these conditions, if I just let them build up for a couple of days because they're a nuisance and delete all, just storing them there, does that affect my computer?
It's a good, simple question. Dan Drucker, we're not all tech geniuses here, so give it to us straight. If the spam just sits there in the file unread and we come back, mass, bulk delete, should we be safe? Should we be clean?
You'll be safe and clean. You just won't be productive.
Well, because we're spending our time doing that.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, there's some comfort in that. Let me go to Washington, D.C., and Dave. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I'm a computer network administrator for a small business here, and we're having huge problems because our email host is slowing down tremendously, and I've been fighting with this problem for a couple of weeks now. I'm going to a meeting about it right now, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is that I am very, very angry at Congress for failing to resolve this problem with the Canned Spam Act. When the act came out in the first place, it was immediately obvious to me that the act would do nothing to resolve this problem, and it didn't. And it seems to me that this is a classic example of where Congress could intervene and provide and impose a solution where computers have to identify themselves when they're sending email, and if they fail to identify themselves, then the email will no longer be accepted.
But
why is Congress not resolving this?
Well, but I mean, if you've got a global situation here, a lot of it outside of U.S. borders, maybe it's in Russia, maybe it's Romania, maybe it's Nigeria, who knows? Can Congress really legislate this away, Dave?
I think so, because you can, if the American government declares that a computer has to identify itself when sending email, the rest of the world will have to go along with that.
But what if that computer that identified itself is one of these botnet zombie computers, just some, you know, sweet little lady in, I don't know, in Wales, and suddenly she's emailing you? You won't know whether to take it or not.
Well, that would be the responsibility of the Internet service provider to notify these users that their service will be cut off if they continue sending spam. It happened to me and my network. We were cut off for 3 days by our Internet service provider because they thought we were spammers.
Let us pick it up. There's a plea for Congress to step in and get tougher on this. Do something. Identify, insist that, you know, the origin ID be right there. Jeff Schiller, can Congress fix it?
I actually don't think so. I don't think this is something that government can really deal with. Government is sort of a blunt axe, and I think if they start swinging it, you will be sorry for what you see.
But what about Dave's suggestion? He's saying make everybody sort of self-identify when they're sending emails so you can cut them off.
Well, actually, there is work in the standards bodies of the Internet to come up with a scheme to exactly do that. It is actually a challenging technical problem.
Why?
There's a lot of things we do with email that would get blocked. So one of the proposals, for example, would make mailing lists be hard to do because, after all, if you get a message that came from me but was sent via a mailing list, the computer that's going to connect to you isn't really my computer. It's the mailing list computer.
So the Christmas letter would be hard to send out online in that case.
Yeah. Now, this is oversimplifying it, but there are technical challenges to doing it, though I think it can be done, and I think eventually it will be done.
Dan Drucker, what would you like to see Congress do? What could Congress do? What can we do with legislation to address this?
Well, I mean, it's our job at Postini to just make the problem go away. So, you know, I think it would be great. I agree with Jeff that this is more likely to be a problem that's fixed by the technical standards committees that define the standards for the Internet. But in the meantime, you know, we just make this go away. And we think that's the simplest and fastest thing to do.
But, you know, here we're reading the bad guys are outrunning us. We've got a global problem. I mean, if you can't fix it on the private side, do we have to have a legal approach to this, a more aggressive legal approach internationally at some point, Dan, or is that just a pipe dream?
In today's climate, what do you do? You know, what do you do as Jeff started to talk about when the source of these things is coming from 100,000 PCs around the world simultaneously that are managed surreptitiously by a network of criminals out of Eastern Europe? You know, that's a very interesting global legal challenge, and it's why I say, you know, I think for now there are plenty of solutions to make this to stop this stuff that people should look at deploying. And Jeff talked about some of those earlier.
Right now, we've got Mike calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm in charge of IT for a medium-sized retailer in Hartford.
Yeah.
And this subject is very timely for us right now. I'm deleting email as I'm listening to the show.
You got a couple today?
More than a couple. And, you know, we're concerned, obviously, as an expense for, you know, to the bottom line. Our outside tech firm is suggesting a pretty expensive solution. And, you know, we're looking at over $12,000 for, you know, an investment of hardware, and then, you know, which would include, you know, anti-spam and antivirus, what have you, on the server side.
$12,000. How do you decide whether to spend that, Mike? What do you weigh it against, that $12,000?
Well, that's a great question. You know, we are trying to decide if we want to spend that. And in addition to that, there's reoccurring costs every year. You know, we have to update the definitions. And, you know, as I've been listening on the show, the spammers are getting more creative, and I have to wonder if the anti-spam companies can keep up with that, and is that a good, you know, investment for us? You know, it's affecting, I believe it affects productivity, We have employees who are frustrated, employees who are missing or deleting emails that are valid.
Right, and right, because you're sort of getting rid of hundreds at a time, and off goes the one that you need. Dan Drucker, what about the economics of this? How do you talk to companies about the cost equation here, and why should we believe you? Because you make money the more scared and fouled up in spam they get.
Well, I can give you hard information, and then businesses and people can make their own decisions mm-hmm. about the economics of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the average customer on our network is attacked by about 80 of these spams per day across our 12 million users, and you look at what is that cost and productivity. And when you add those things together with the human impact of this, plus the fact that, you know, for a retailer like we're talking about, you know, if your email stops going through or slows down, that's a tax on your business if you can't communicate with your suppliers, for example. So most businesses will find this is a CEO-level thing now, and this is just one of those costs of doing business. And the costs, frankly, aren't that high. To stop this problem. They shouldn't be as high as the caller's talking about.
And the productivity cost, if it's not addressed, how do you weigh it? How do you measure it?
Well, you look at how many of these things for your average for the average person you're getting per day. How long does it take them? Really, two aspects. How long does it take them to keep their email inbox clean, like you just heard? The other hidden cost here is when you get messages when you don't get good messages you want to get because you delete them by accident or your filters delete them.
Right.
That's a really big problem.
I want to get one more perspective here, Dan. Jeff Shaler, please stand by. Joining us from Naperville, Illinois, is Lance Spitzner. He's president and founder of the HoneyNet Project. It's a nonprofit that uses technology to track spammers and organized internet criminals. Lance Spitzner, thanks a lot for being with us. What is it you do?
Thanks, Tom. We run a nonprofit resource organization that captures information about the bad guys, and then we give it away for free.
How do you catch them? What's the honeypot part of this?
Okay. What it is we're a little different. We build entire networks of real computers and operating systems, the same that are on the internet. We deploy these networks around the world, and the bad guys break into them. We want them to hack us.
Yep.
When they do, we capture everything they do, we analyze it, and then we share that with the community.
So you look to make a kind of sexy, attractive target for them. Who are you catching in your honeypot? What's the profile? Who's out there spamming?
First of all, you don't have to do anything sexy. You just have to put any computer out there. That's a big misconception.
Okay.
The bad guys are targeting the end user. What we tend to see is it's primarily all criminally motivated. It's the same criminals, the same organized crime, most likely, that's been going on for years. They've just adopted this new technology. We do tend to see a lot of Eastern Europeans involved simply because there's a lot of technology, a lot of sharp people there, but the economy's hurting.
And so they're sitting around without jobs, but they've got a whole world to sort of mess with via spam.
Via spam or other means, but yes, absolutely. It's a good way for them to make money at a very low risk.
And once you identify an individual or, let's say, a crime syndicate that's involved in this, what happens?
What happens? Well, that depends. Normally, that's a law enforcement issue, so you'd have to talk to law enforcement. On our end, all we do is analyze the information and then release it to the public or share some of it with law enforcement to help them.
And have you seen them act on that? I mean, the public, it's tough for me to go to Romania and knock on the door of some underemployed geek who's, you know, spamming me. But does Interpol or anybody actually do that?
They're working very, very hard on this because it is a big problem, but it's so difficult because there's so many different pieces involved. You have to identify the person first, then you have to, you know, maintain the evidence, and then you have to try to prosecute them in a foreign country. And a lot of times, we may not have relationships with the foreign country, or if we do, the spammer can just pay off the local authorities, and then nobody will bother them anymore.
So what are you saying? What's your advice? If I get spam, I click on some link there, what am I at risk of, Lance?
Well, the problem is it's just not a business impact. The problem is you can be compromised. A lot of spam not only includes wants your personal information, but for the ways for them to make money is to take over your computer. So, for example, if there's new exploits going around in Word documents, you may get a spam email that has a very innocent-looking Word document, but if you click on it, it'll take over your computer.
And turn me into one of these botnet zombie computers or do something else?
Well, absolutely. Just turn your computer into whatever way the bad guys can make the most money. It's purely a business model now.
once they've taken over, quote unquote, my computer, can they go in and read all my stuff, my passwords, my credit card numbers? Can they figure that out?
Absolutely. In many ways, once they've compromised your system, they have more control of it than you do.
Lance Spitzner at the Honeypot Project in Naperville, Illinois. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Absolutely, Tom. Thanks.
Douglas is calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Douglas. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
We're good.
Hey, I use an operating system called Linux.
Sure.
And basically, it defeats a lot of this, like I'm turning my system into a zombie, because a lot of the stuff that makes your computer a zombie is basically Microsoft driven. And so when I run a Linux system, my system is not a zombie anymore.
Right, so get out of the omnipresent Microsoft world and you feel a little safer, a little less targeted. Jeff Schiller, how about it? Does it make a difference if you're running Microsoft, Linux, Mac operating systems? What's the landscape?
Well, I'm a Linux user, so that's what I carry on my laptop, and that's how I read my email. And that, just by being different from the mainstream, that helps a lot. Though I do have to caution people, just because you're not running a Windows operating system doesn't mean that you shouldn't be making sure that you're up to date on the various security problems that exist in all operating systems, Linux and Macintosh as well.
And what about Mac? Is it less targeted by spammers than Microsoft at this point?
Yeah, particularly Mac OS X is much more resistant to the kind of things these guys are doing.
How can it be more? I mean, Bill Gates said, we're going to stop this. Why is Mac ahead? Is there something fundamental to the Mac system that's different? Are they just more aggressive with their security patches they send out?
Well, I mean, Mac OS X is based on Unix, which is, you know, the same as Linux. And this is an operating system that I won't say was designed with security in it from the ground up, but the people who designed it had a lot more security clue than the people who originally designed Windows. And so Windows has been playing catch-up. A lot of the new innovations that Microsoft will tell you they're putting into Vista have been in Unix and Linux for years.
Mm-hmm. So some advantage there. Let me get a call from Chicago. Don's on the line. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, why can't individuals who work in the institutions create their own whitelist, that is, their own set of emails they will accept, and then anything else goes into either a junk mail or a pending folder. I use an email service called Blue Bottle, and that's how that works.
So you want to actively sign off. This is who I'll accept email from, and everything else would go elsewhere. Do you worry, Don, that may cut you off from something that you might want that you just haven't thought to give a green light to?
Not necessarily. I pretty much have an idea of who is sending me stuff in the business that I work. And with the Postini system, you have to keep rewriting rules, and you're fighting the last bit of spam. That's the problem with the Postini system.
Dan, we've got Don in Chicago speaking straight to your business there. What do you say? He wants to just put up a list of approved emailers, and everybody else get lost.
So what we, speaking on what we've seen happen across, 10 million people, you can absolutely do what's called whitelisting. Say, here are the people that I'm going to accept email from. What will happen, though, is that if any of those are well-known people or companies, you'll find that the bad guys will imitate them and spam will start to get through. So it's one tool you can use in part of an overall strategy.
Jeff, what about an active approved mailers list? Can you see that as functional?
Well, I think that helps, but again, you have to be careful. One of the things that some email-borne viruses do is they go into people's address books and send mail to everybody that person knows.
Yeah.
So if someone on your whitelist gets an infection, you may get mail that you think is from them that seems to be harmless because that's somebody you talk to all the time. But really, it's a hostile payload that's going to get into your computer.
A hostile payload. What a world. Robert's calling from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks. I have an observation and a question.
Yes.
The observation is that one of the things you have to watch out for are advertisements for anti-spam and anti-adware software, because a lot of times those are scams, and they end up installing those little pop-ups on your the bottom line.
Yeah. So be careful who you turn to for security.
But that's right. The other question is, you've talked a lot about your computer being taken over as a bot. Is there a way to tell if that's happened? And if it has, is there a way to address that?
Right. If my computer's been zombified, pulled into a botnet, Jeff Schiller, how do I know?
Well, it sometimes can be very hard to tell because some of these bots are, hide very well. But one giveaway is if the disk drive is clattering away and you're not using the computer. And mm-hmm. you got to be careful because Windows will sometimes compress its disk and do things.
Mm-hmm.
But if the network, if you have a light on your network card and that light is flickering on and off, and again, you're not doing anything with your computer, that's a pretty good hint.
So if I'm not banging on the computer myself and it's still sort of, you know, clicking and popping and wheezing, as our earlier caller said, somebody else may be using it.
That's absolutely true.
Wow. Alex is calling from Arlington, Virginia. Alex, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I just want to let you know that there is an office, Secret Service office in Romania, who's in charge of monitoring those hackers from there, and the local authorities are very, very cooperative, and they've been catching quite a few of these guys lately. So they've been operating there since 2000.
Alex, it sounds like you know something about this. Let's say the Romanian hackers who may be involved in this, and of course they're all over, and plenty of Americans as well, no doubt. But what's the incentive? Is it purely a money thing at this point, or still the pride of the hack?
It's exactly something like that. I mean, they have nothing else to do, so they have access to all this new technology, and of course they have very. I mean, there's no way for them to make an honest living out of this. So it's just a passion. I mean, that's and it's kind of a. I remember when I was living there and I was going to the post office, I would see all these young kids getting from the U.S. mostly from the U.S. those very expensive cameras and equipment, and it was all done with whatever they were hacking there. I saw them bribing the postal officials to put a smaller custom fee on those goods.
Wow, a passion to deliver the spam and make a buck in the process. Alex, thanks for your call. Dan Drucker, do you, Alex says there's a Secret Service unit right there. Do you cooperate with law enforcement authorities, or are these different streams?
Different streams. So what we really do in our job is to try to make this problem transparent to people. So like I said earlier, it just goes away. You know, law enforcement, as Lance said, is really a separate issue. We try to keep compartmentalized from this.
Right. So you're not necessarily working hand in glove with them. Jeff Schiller, what about it? Do you feel law enforcement at work as you do your work to stop spam?
Well, you know, most of the spam coming from overseas, it's just not worth pursuing. It's effectively wasting their time, and it wastes our time. Now, if we have a situation...
Not worth pursuing, but we're told it may be the bulk of the spam that's out there.
Well, you know, a friend of mine had a great analogy. It's like, we all hate cockroaches, but the way you get rid of them is you don't step on them one at a time.
Right, but if you go to the source, does that not mean going globally, wherever the source is, wherever the syndicate may be that's pumping this stuff out?
Well, if there were really one syndicate or even a dozen mm-hmm. syndicates that you actually had a chance of rounding up and stopping, that would be worthwhile. But I'm not sure that that's really what we're looking at. And it's not sure that if you eliminated one group, that another group wouldn't immediately step in.
So it's not so much about going to the source, but really figuring out the wall that will stop it, filter it, identify it.
Yeah, and again, I don't think we'll ever be 100% successful, but I think we have to keep trying.
Dan Drucker, what do you see as the future here? We've got some in your business saying the bad guys are simply outrunning us. Is that what, you know, the next century looks like? Is there a way to sort of get around, get leverage on this problem and really tamp it down?
Well, we believe we're still staying ahead, and we can demonstrate that.
Mm-hmm.
But it clearly the source of this will continue to get worse. And when you say look into the future, you know, the reason email is the target is because it's ubiquitous. Everybody uses it. You can predict that there will be other targets for the same stuff. The web, as people use instant messaging, as people use other kinds of electronic communications, they're going to attack those because they're ubiquitous targets too.
But as this comes on, as you say, onto our cell phones, as we've got technology that's identifying us, as we move through shopping malls and all the rest, at credit card stations, I mean, are we going to have to be constantly afraid that the virtual world around us is tinged with bogusness?
It's just like the real world. There are bad guys out there that will take advantage of human trust.
Wow, just like the real world. There's a thought, and we thought it was going to be the best of all possible worlds out there, or maybe for 5 seconds we did. That's a picture. Dan Drucker, good luck with your work, and thank you very much for being with us this hour. It's been great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
Dan Drucker, Vice President for Marketing at Postini. They do a lot of work in stopping spam. And Jeff Schiller, it's been great of you to come in and share your insight with us this hour. We'll try and incorporate a little bit of that in our thinking about how to stay safe here. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeff Schiller, Network Manager for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.